Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. On today's program, I'll be featuring another in my Framing Our Democracy series. My guest is Uta Ritz-Deutsch. Ritz-Deutsch is a graduate of the University of Binghamton, where she received her PhD in history. She is currently a part-time professor at SUNY Cortland and at Tompkins Cortland Community College. She is also the New York State Area Coordinator for Amnesty International USA and host of the Human Rights and Social Justice Program on WRFI Radio. She is an immigrant from West Germany, now a naturalized citizen of the U.S., and is a longtime human rights and social justice activist. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tish.
Now, I want you to tell us a little bit about your family history in West Germany. Your parents, very affected by World War II. Tell us a little bit about the history.
Yeah, so my parents were both kids during the war. My dad was born in 1930, my mom in 1938. But the family was quite different because my dad's side of the family, they lived in Germany. And my grandfather on that side, he was politically active, you know, he was actually a member of the Communist Party. He printed anti-Nazi pamphlets and put himself at great risk. And, you know, starting as early as 1934, he was in and out of prison because of his anti-Nazi activities. And he also spent close to a year in Dachau in the concentration camp, which he survived. Interestingly, that part of the history of my grandfather, I never knew when I was growing up. I learned many, many years after he had passed away. And, you know, I wish I had known, right? Because I would have liked to have some conversations with him. But back then, people just in general didn't like talking about the war.
Wow. So you were brought up steeped in this history, I'm sure, at least when you got a little bit older. When did your family come to the U.S. and for what reason?
Actually, let me step back a minute and tell you about my mom's side of the family, because that's a very different story. My mom's side of the family at the time of the war lived in what was then the country of Yugoslavia, which also now no longer exists. But so this is in the Balkans, and my ancestors on that side of the family, they moved there in the 1780s. And this was part of a colonization scheme that the Austrian crown, the Habsburgs, set up. So they were actually financially supporting German-speaking settlers to move into those regions. It was, you know, after they had concluded the wars with the Ottomans and so on. So, you know, the Austrian crown had an agenda to settle the area with German speakers and to sort of create a bulwark against Muslims, right? Let's just be blunt about it. But to make a long story short, so they'd been living in that area since the 1780s. And there were, in the Balkans, at the outbreak of World War II, about 1.5 million Germans, ethnic Germans, in Yugoslavia and Hungary and in Romania. And so Yugoslavia is where my family is from. But you have Nazi occupation, right? You have basically a war, but then also a civil war, and things got very, very nasty. When Germany occupied Yugoslavia, they basically forced all the ethnic Germans to join the German military.
Wow.
And so, you know, my grandfather was first in the Yugoslav army and then in the German army, and he died on the Russian front. But at the end of the war, actually in late 44, the vast majority of ethnic Germans were cleansed out of the Balkans, including Yugoslavia. If you look at different ethnic groups within Germany, so that particular group is known as the Danube Swabians, or in German, Donauschwaben. They had the highest civilian casualty rate of any German ethnic group. So when I was growing up, right, so my mom was born in 38, you know, she was a year old when the war broke out. She was six when they were basically forced out of the country. So they lost everything. They lost their house, they lost their farm, they lost all of their belongings, they lost their Yugoslav citizenship. They were basically stateless people, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And they ended up on this long trek back to, you know, Germany. It took several years for the family to recongregate, but they basically resettled in the area where my dad's family is from. And that's, you know, that's how ultimately they met. But growing up, I was very close to my great-grandparents, and I grew up on these stories of displacement, of being expelled people, of being refugees. And I mean, even decades later, right, my great-grandparents were still so attached to their homeland, which was, you know, Yugoslavia. So that really shaped me a lot.
Yeah. How old were you when you came here, though? Your family must have come here after the war.
Yeah, actually, I came by myself.
Ah.
Yeah, so all of my original family is still in Germany. I'm the only one who left. I was 20 at the time, so I finished high school there and just felt very strongly that I needed to get out of there. You know, on some level, it was just not feeling like I belonged, and there are numerous reasons for that. But one of them is that I was extremely alienated by the Holocaust and what that means, and I had a hard time coming to terms with it. So I came at the age of 20, you know, tried to go to college, and my first try failed, but you know, I got married, I had kids, and then a few years later I went back, and then you know, it was tough because I was in the beginning working full time, going to school part time, and then I lost my job. I was going to school full time, but then also, you know, working too. Once I got to the level of graduate school, I was also.
So do you think your family history is one of the reasons why you decided to study history and become a history professor?
Absolutely.
Try to learn more about your own family.
Absolutely. And even up to the master's level, I was studying that particular history. And then I took a step back from that. So ultimately, my area of expertise became German immigrants in southern Brazil at the turn of the 20th century. So it's still immigration history. And I also looked at conflicts they had with indigenous peoples. You know, I'm interested in immigrant rights and indigenous rights, but, you know, just fundamentally human rights.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let's fast forward to what's happening right now. You must have chills about what's happening in regard to immigration in this country right now.
Oh, absolutely.
Talk to us about, I mean, talking about full circle.
Yep.
Tell us what your feelings are coming from a country where your family was pretty much, you know, expelled.
Yeah, and, you know, the way I grew up, I felt that both sides of my family were victimized by the war, were victimized by this dictator. I know it's hard coming from the context of German history to even speak of victimhood, but, you know, if you have civilians, if you have children, right, and they basically have experienced the consequences of war. They're innocent. I don't care what their parents or grandparents did, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, but you know, the one thing I really had trouble with when I was growing up is I thought, well, why did these atrocities happen in Germany? You know, is there something peculiarly evil about Germans, something that makes Germans more susceptible to, let's say, getting drawn in by a dictator, right?
Yeah.
Of course, becoming a historian, I learned, and I don't know if this was necessarily comforting, but I learned, no, it can happen to any country.
Absolutely.
It can happen to any group of
and
people.
And we may see it starting to happen here in the West. Honestly, it's frightening. I think of Nazi Germany. I think of the history of 1933, when everybody thought Hitler was a fool and an idiot.
Yep.
And the same language.
And the parallels are just amazing, right? And as a historian, of course, it's very unsettling, but it also makes me even more committed to speak out, right? I mean, I cannot keep my mouth shut.
Well, you know, right? That's the good thing that's happened with this whole evolution, because a lot of people are speaking out, and journalists are really coming to the table and doing their job even better. It's been amazing.
And that's a really good point. If I look at the pushback, if I look at people who used to sit on the sidelines and now no longer are, those are really, really good things. And the other point I want to make is that, you know, erosion of rights, it happens in stages and it creeps up on you. And it's, you know, it might be very subtle, but basically it's a change that happens. And here in this country, in terms of erosion of civil rights, you know, let's just say 9/11, right?
Oh, yeah.
We had the Patriot Act. Yep. Yep.
You know.
And mass surveillance and all of that. And, you know, in the beginning, one, people are told, we have to do this because we're in danger, right? Which reminds me of a Goebbels quote, because he said, you know, and he's one of the people tried at the Nuremberg trials, right?
Absolutely.
He said, if you want to draw people into war, it's really easy. And it doesn't matter if it's a monarchy or a dictatorship or a democracy. All you have to tell them is that they're under attack. Yep. It works every time.
And I can keep you safe. Only I can keep you safe. Those are such typical lines for a dictatorship to start growing. I understand that. You know what I want to ask you, too? I know you're a coordinator for Amnesty International.
Right.
So has Amnesty International, especially the local that you're involved in, have they changed their mission because of what's happening in our government and in our culture right now? Or are you still more concerned with international issues?
I mean, we do both. Mm-hmm. We work on international issues. I mean, the organization started out internationally and originally
started out in London, didn't it? Yeah.
It did, right. Mm-hmm. And initially, in the early stages of history with Amnesty International, people only worked on cases that were not in their country.
Uh-huh.
Because there was a risk. You know, I mean, if you're a political dissident and you speak out in your own country and you push for human rights, you yourself may be targeted, right? Mm-hmm. But this has shifted in recent years, and Amnesty has started to take on domestic issues. So, for example, we've worked for a long time now on death penalty issues, but you mentioned Guantanamo. So we've been working on that, right? On unlawful detentions. We've been working on torture, which of course happens not just abroad, but also in places like Guantanamo.
Yeah, and they are trying to resurrect that idea of that works.
And that's okay, right?
And also sanctuary cities. I mean, that's another target that's happening. And the safe places are shrinking as we speak.
You know, I'm not sure, because I also have heard a lot of people from around the country who've asked me, my church is considering to maybe becoming a sanctuary church.
Ah.
So I think there's also increasing interest in that, you know.
So that's another thing that's happening in response, which is positive.
Yep.
Wow.
And so to tell you a little bit more about Amnesty, so we right now have two major campaigns, and the campaigns usually last for several years, and that's sort of spearheaded from the international office in London. But one of the campaigns is defending or protecting human rights defenders, right? So if you speak out and you're targeted, let's say you're in Saudi Arabia and you send a tweet and you end up getting a 20-year prison sentence, right? That would fall under that category. Mm-hmm. But it could also be, organizers here in the U.S. It could really be anywhere, right? So protecting human rights defenders is one of the big campaigns, and a lot of different smaller campaigns can be part of that in terms of advocating on behalf of individuals. And the other one, the other major campaign basically has to do with, the campaign is called I Welcome, but you have refugees, asylum seekers, migrants, all of, those people who are at risk because they're moving, right? They're leaving their country, they're forced out, whether or not by war or for other reasons. That is the other major campaign, and that we're going to be working on as well. So
The work continues.
The work continues.
It's amazing. You know what I want to ask you, too, as a historian, somebody who's into communications, how are we all, and I say that we because we all are in this, going to deal with this fake news virus that seems to be taking over our country? How do we even win when the war is being used with fake words, it's unbelievable.
That's a real challenge. Yeah, because basically, and this is, this is also a tactic of dictatorships, right? In dictatorships, what happens? You get the courts, the judiciary attacked, right? You get the media attacked and discredited, right? You go after people who challenge you, right? So discrediting the media is part of that, right? And I think this started happening last year, I think it's been in process for some time, but really came to the fore last year. People, I think, have a hard time now distinguishing between here's a news outlet that does serious research for their article, or, here is someone who just, makes outrageous statements that have no basis in reality. And on some level, these have been equated as being news, right? And that's really, really difficult.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Uta Ritz-Deutsch. We're doing one of our Framing Our Democracy series. We're talking about human rights and subjects such as fake news. You want to continue on that line regard to fighting this fake news?
Yeah, that's really, really tough. And, you know, one of the things that we've also seen leading up to the election is that all of us are in our little news bubble, right? So if somebody only gets their news from Fox News, and we know Fox News has on occasion blatantly lied, right? Fabricated stories.
They've even had to admit it, that's a good thing, a little bit of light.
Yep. But if that's your source of news, if all you get is Fox News and the president's Twitter, your sense of reality is going to be quite different from mine. And, you know, I no longer have cable. I don't pay a lot of attention to the corporate news. I go to a lot of alternative news sources. Mm-hmm. But, of course, you have to trust those sources, right? I like Democracy Now!, for example. But, I mean, that's not the only outlet, right? But I trust that at least some research is being done. And I mean, okay, sometimes the details,
you
know,
might
be off.
People make mistakes, too.
Right, but the bulk of the work is solid, right? Mm-hmm. And one of the challenges is now, you know, how do we talk to people who are in their own bubble and try to open them up to, you know, what, of course, from my perspective is reality, right?
Well, we really have come to that. It's turned into a black and white situation in many ways.
Yeah.
Lies versus truth, real journalism versus people throwing out opinions as news, you know.
Yeah, and, you know, I find it really challenging also for the classroom.
I was gonna ask you, how are you dealing with your students in this realm?
You know, in the fall semester, right around the election, we were just coming up on fascism. So the timing was really good to talk about all of it. And if you look at, all right, here is the fear-mongering, here's the scapegoating of a particular group. I mean, okay, here in the U.S., it might not be the Jewish community, right? It's going to be Latinos, and it's going to be Muslims. And
transgender community,
Now. You know, so there might be a difference in terms of which particular group is targeted. But the fact that you have specific groups you're targeting, you take people's fear and anger, you channel it into hatred, you focus it on a particular group of people, and then you may even call for violence. All of that we've seen, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's really tricky to talk about it in the classroom because I do have students in class who are Trump supporters, right? And if I come on too strong, they're going to shut down and they're not going to hear anything that I say.
Yeah, yeah.
So how to handle it was really, really tricky. You know, I try to frame it in the sense of, all right, let's get everybody just together to talk about what are the issues you care about. And if you come at it from an issues perspective, interestingly, right, there is overlap in almost all of the issues, right? There's just a real difference in opinion in terms of who can solve those problems,
uh-huh,
right?
Uh-huh.
I mean, at the end, you know, I think a lot of discussions happen outside the classroom that I'm not privy to, so I really don't know how much of an impact it's had. But in general, I find it really challenging because students nowadays, you know, they grew up with smartphones, and they're used to getting information in these very short tidbits. You know, they might get their main news from Twitter.
Yeah, just from a headline.
Or just from a headline,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And even just, you know, I mean, when I grew up, we had to do serious reading and, you know, be able to sit down for several hours and read and be very concentrated on what we were reading. I can no longer assume that my students have those skills.
And then that's what scares me, too, because there's no analysis. And people can just be provoked by a line and just start parroting it, as we have seen in Nazi Germany and here. You know, lock her up. Lock, you know.
Yeah.
That kind of just chanting and parroting back one-liners.
Yeah. And that's of real concern, you know. How do we get people as you were saying earlier, to tell the difference between, you know, serious news and just, you know, some outrageous statement somebody posts, you know, on social media.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what do you think the chief human rights issue is in this country right now for Americans especially? Is it trying to keep people sort of on the path of truth?
You know, that's interesting that you should phrase it that way. I mean, having access to truth is not necessarily a human right. Mm. But there are a lot of things that are happening with this administration that are quite alarming. And going back to Amnesty International, one of the things that we're also working on is policing, right? Enforcement policies and also practices, right? And a subset thereof is police brutality, right? And we have a report, for example, on what happened in Ferguson and so on. First of all, people have the right to protest, to peaceful protest, right?
Yeah,
people
yeah.
have the right. People have the right to freedom of expression, assembly, and so on. And the police are supposed to use the least force, right? Minimum force.
Mm-hmm.
And what we're seeing is, you know, we've made really slow and incremental progress over the last few years, and now all of that is eroding very quickly. And to me, it is very alarming that you have a commander-in-chief who seems to encourage police brutality, right? Who says, if you're arresting somebody, you know, don't worry about slamming their head into the car.
Yeah, no, don't be so nice.
You know, and I mean, first of all, it goes against the procedures that are in place in a lot of police departments around the country, right? But also, you know, there is an assumption of innocence in this country.
That's what I was just going to say. Just because you're picked up by the police doesn't mean you're guilty.
It doesn't mean anything.
And so some people are losing that fine line. It's really frightening. You've written a lot about solitary confinement in prisons, too. That's another place of human rights abuses
over
the place.
In this country, huge. You know, it's very interesting because we have, and again, coming from the perspective of a historian, we have these so-called national myths, right? And one of these is land of the free, right? And the truth of the matter is that the United States is the leader in incarceration worldwide.
And that's an absolute fact, folks.
That is an absolute fact.
Yep.
That's not my opinion, right?
Yep.
It's based on research. The United States has more people in prison in terms of total numbers than any other country in the world, and that includes China, which has three times as many people. And the United States also has the highest percentage of its population in prison.
It's unbelievable.
You know, and it's like six times higher than a lot of European countries. So something has gone really wrong in this country, right? And then if you look at how people are treated in prison, solitary confinement, which again should only be used in extreme cases, right?
And for limited times.
Yep. Here in the United States, and again, if you compare it worldwide, the U.S. has between 5 and 6% of the world's population. It has close to 25% of the world's prisoners. It has around 50% of the world's prisoners in solitary confinement. So of all the prisoners in solitary held around the world, 50% of them are locked up here in the United States.
It's staggering. It's absolutely staggering. You know what I want to ask you, too? Amnesty International has always been famous for letter-writing campaigns.
Yep.
Do you think those still work? And with the new media, are there other ways that people are trying to free people and get reasonable outcomes?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there are different methods, different tactics. Certainly, letter writing is still what our local chapter here in Ithaca does. We meet every month, always the third Tuesday of the month, 7:30 in the Cahin Center, which is 640 Stewart Ave. Mm. It's open to the public. You don't have to be a member. We write letters. That's mostly what we do. But a lot of people only do online petitions, right?
Uh-huh.
So you can do that. If you go to amnestyusa.org, we have urgent actions all the time. If you're concerned about a particular issue or a particular country, you can do a keyword search once you're in that site. Urgent actions. You can also sign up to receive urgent action alerts. And then as you get them in your email, you can just respond. So it's very easy that way. But after all is said and done, the digital actions are not as powerful as the written actions.
That's amazing to know that that's still the case after all these years.
After all these years, you know, and since Amnesty was founded in 1961, over 47,000 prisoners have been released, prisoners on whose behalf we've advocated, right?
Yeah, it's been a very effective organization, and no question.
Yeah, and you know, we're not the only organization working on behalf of a particular individual. You know, sometimes it takes many years, so you kind of have to get a thick skin in terms of getting rejections. I mean, rejections in the sense of not getting the results that you want. You have to be in it for the long term, right? I mean, we've worked on some cases for years, and sometimes you don't know if it's because of your letter writing that somebody got released, or you know, if other things came into play. But yes, it still works, and God, we still do it. But you know, there are other tactics as well, and lobbying is something that we're doing more of. So for example, Amnesty International USA has signed off on solitary confinement reform in New York State, right? So lobbying for the HALT Solitary Confinement Act, so HALT, H-A-L-T, it stands for Humane Alternatives to Long-Term Solitary Confinement. Our Ithaca chapter also coordinates with an organization called CAIC, so that acronym CAIC stands for Campaign for Alternatives to Isolated Confinement. And, you know, we try to get this state bill passed. And if it were to pass, and we're actually, every year we're getting a little bit closer, it would limit the use of solitary confinement to 15 days max. It would really only be for violent people. Right now, 5 out of 6 cases are minor administrative cases,
right? Oh, I know.
Cases,
and a lot
right?
of them are really young people.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
what kills me.
Yeah.
That's called rehabilitation. No human contact. That makes no sense to me.
It doesn't. How can somebody get well, right? And then they get released into the community, and they're damaged, and it's hard for the entire community to try and help them reintegrate. So
that's a great campaign. God, kudos to Amnesty for really being on that. You know, I want to ask you this, too. Do you go back to Germany, and what is Europe mm-hmm. thinking about what's evolving in this country right now? They must be, you know, absolutely stunned.
Yeah, I do go back. You know, when I was first here, when the kids were little and we were quite poor, I hardly ever got home. But in recent years, I try to go home at least once a year. You know, my mom's elderly now, and, you know, I want to see her as much as I can. You know, I find myself much more reconciled to Germany than I was as a young person when I left. You know, Germany's been the leader on many fronts. Germany's had one of the most liberal asylum laws in the entire world, you know. So trying to make amends for what went wrong with the Holocaust.
Yeah, Germany has really
has stepped up in many ways.
To be a real leader in democracy. You know?
So that part of it I really appreciate. However, in Europe, I'm seeing also a lot of Islamophobia, xenophobia, you know, fear of terrorists, fear of immigrants, and that really troubles me.
Yeah. Well, Uta, we're almost out of time. Can you give some contact information, your website, and how people can get in touch with you?
Sure. So the Amnesty International chapter of Ithaca, you can find us on Facebook. So if you have a Facebook account, look for Ithaca. Amnesty International. I'm also involved with the Tompkins County Immigrant Rights Coalition, and you can find that organization also on Facebook, and we have a WordPress page as well. And then with WRFI Community Radio, I have the Human Rights and Social Justice Program. And once again, if you go to Facebook, look for WRFI Human Rights and Social Justice Program. You can find me there as well.
Great. Well, Uta Ritz-Deutsch, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure. Keep up the great work. Thank you on behalf of all of us for joining us, too.
And thank you, Tish. It's, you know, thanks for the invitation. It's been great.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega, and we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.